This is Jeff Blankford.
My guest on this final edition of Takes on the World, Phil Giraldi, should be familiar to Takes on the World listeners because he's been a guest here numerous times over the years. A former CIA case officer, an Army intelligence officer who spent 20 years overseas in Europe and the Middle East, he currently heads the Council for the National Interest, an organization of former U.S. officials and politicians who don't think our interest is served by supporting Israel. He frequently writes on elements of that issue that are taboo even in the alternative media, such as the one that was published in UN's Review on May 28th, entitled Israel's Role in 9/11, FBI Evidence Supports Prior Knowledge of Complicity, which focuses not on the how of 9/11 as much as the who. Welcome once again, Phil Giraldi, to Takes on the World.
Well, thank you for having me on again, Jeff.
It's great. When I read your May 28th article and looked at the calendar, I knew you were the guest I wanted on 9/11. What you write and the questions you raised are largely ignored, even by many who question the official 9/11 story. It is evidently okay to speak about the hidden Saudi connections, but to write or speak about Israel's prior knowledge or possible complicity in the attack on the World Trade Center is off limits, even for the most of the alternative media. How do you explain that?
I think it's simply a question of we've come to a point in the United States and perhaps beyond the United States where people don't really trust the government anymore. And 9/11 obviously was a major incident which immediately started a lot of creative thinking about what might have actually happened on 9/11. The reason why the Israeli connection is not brought up more often is the simple fact that supporters of Israel are very powerful in the media. Supporters of Israel are very powerful in the government. So it is in a subject that is some people characterize as the 600-pound gorilla in the room. Everybody knows about it, but nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, there some events happened that day, and I reported on March 27, 2002, from an article I had seen in the Jewish Weekly Forward about five Israelis who had been arrested that morning, three of whom were identified in the article as Mossad agents, identified by name, who were working for a Mossad front, something called Urban Moving Company. And at the end of the article, the writer, Mark Perelman, wondered why the story had not been picked up in the mainstream media. And recently, actually, when I went back to find that article, I found out it had been entirely changed and a new twist had been added to that. Tell us about what happened that day.
Okay. Well, it's actually the account that appeared in that article and that appeared in more abbreviated forms in some other mainstream media publications. It was essentially that five Israelis were seen allegedly celebrating as the Twin Towers were going down. They were noticed and they were photographed by people in the apartment buildings near where they were engaged in this. The police were called. They were arrested. And it turned out that one of them had two passports. They had $4,000 in cash in their workers' van. They claimed to be a moving company, as you noted. And when a search dog was brought in to sniff the van, explosives were detected, apart from anything else. So there were a whole lot of indications that these guys might have been up to something. There was simultaneously FBI rather extensive knowledge of a major Israeli spying operation going on in the United States, which was, as I say, known about, but the United States government did nothing to stop it. And so there were a lot of things that sort of came together to indicate that these gentlemen have in some way been connected with what might have occurred on that day. So it gets complicated because there have been frequent attempts to figure out what was going on with them. They were held for 70 days. They were polygraphed, and they were eventually let go by the intervention of the federal government's attorney general. So they basically, the mystery of who these guys were and so on and so forth has continued to a certain extent to this day.
Well, you mentioned that in your article, it's some failed the polygraph tests. One evidently took 7 polygraphs. What's the significance of that?
Well, you know, the polygraph is a tool, and basically it detects the physiological changes that people go through when they're feeling guilty about lying. That means that these guys, were whatever the questions were, and of course we don't know what they were exhibiting these physical symptoms to suggest that they had been lying about things. And I would add that after they were released, the Israeli government more or less admitted that at least 3 of them were Mossad agents, and the other 2 were assisting. So it wasn't exactly like it was hypothetical about what they were doing and what their role was. And indeed, they tried to sue the U.S. government for what they claimed was abuse while they were in prison. So it's, you know, essentially the idea that these were intelligence officers is pretty clear.
Well, one of the things that was kind of clear as well, and as you mentioned, they were filming and celebrating the burning towers. And this outraged a woman, housewife, as you wrote, who saw them doing this and called the cops, gave the license plate, and then they were arrested as they were going to Manhattan where they discovered what you described was found in their van. But what was the significance of the film? You reported there was some new evidence in terms of when they went over the film, they found one with a date of September 10th on it.
Yeah, this is the interesting part. And to me, this is the definitive information that tells you that not only did the Israelis have some prior knowledge, they must have had very extensive prior knowledge of what was about to take place. That's not to say for sure that they were partners in it, but they certainly had prior knowledge. What happened was that in May of this year, there was a Freedom of Information Act request, and that request produced 14 photos that these gentlemen had been taking of themselves while celebrating and otherwise. And this tied in with additional information from witnesses that the van of these people had been moving around in the same area. Now, this is a part of New Jersey that overlooks Manhattan and overlooks the Twin Towers. Now, that van had been moving in the same area that morning, and there were photographs that were photo-dated from the camera that were the day before, that were September 10th. And they showed these guys holding up, like, lighters and pretending that there was a fire. And they were standing in the same spot that they were standing in on the next day when the Twin Towers were hit and were burning. So the presumption has to be that these guys had prior knowledge, and on the day when the actual attack took place, they were also seen circling the area, obviously looking for a good place to park and take some pictures. And so prior knowledge, absolutely. And this is the first definitive information, in my opinion, that demonstrates that the Israeli spy service, Mossad, had prior knowledge of 9/11 and apparently, of course, did not share that.
These people became known as the dancing Israelis on the Internet, and that was what President Trump was referring to when he claimed that in New Jersey, Muslims were celebrating the bombing of the towers. Do you remember that? Do you recall that?
Yeah, I do recall that. I mean, Trump said, yeah, there was these Muslims that were celebrating the towers, and of course, in fact, they were Israelis.
Maybe he really doesn't know the difference. You know, one of the things that you write that well before 9/11, The Israelis were running a sophisticated intelligence operation inside the United States, and law enforcement was well aware of it, even if the public was not. Tell us about it.
Well, the Israelis have a peculiar exemption when they run spy operations in the United States, and that persists to this day. Essentially, at any given time, there are scores, if not hundreds, of Israeli intelligence officers operating in the United States, and many law enforcement people and the FBI and the local law enforcement know that they are there and they are doing this, but the Justice Department never, ever makes any attempt to arrest or prosecute these people. And the various worst punishment that they give to them is they make them go back to Israel if they're doing something truly awful. So this has been a persistent pattern. An FBI agent who was in counterintelligence, which is the group that would monitor foreign spies, after he retired a few years back, claimed that he personally knew of at least 100 cases were Israeli spies that they had a good case on to arrest them, were allowed to go free and go back home.
My guest is Phil Giraldi, a former CIA case officer, who knows of what he speaks. We also had a situation you write that in its annual classified counterespionage review, the FBI invariably places Israel at the top for friendly countries that spy on the U.S. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the FBI is obligated by Congress, basically, every year put out a report on foreign spying against the United States, and they categorize the spies by countries that are not friendly and countries that are at least ostensibly friendly. And Israel is always either at the top of the list or number two. Recently, I've noted that the FBI is no longer making public this report. It used to be every year it came out and you could go over and look at it. But apparently people are offended by what it implies, and it's no longer a public document. But that's essentially what it is. And most of the Israeli spying is what you would kind of expect. It's stealing technology that's related to weapons. It's stealing technology that has dual usages that can be exploited commercially. So most of their spying is in that area. But there is, of course, considerable spying on Congress and on White House staffers, Pentagon staffers, that sort of thing. A lot of that, though, is that kind of spying is run out of the embassy.
How much do you think of do they work with AIPAC on this in their spying?
I would say that they actually probably the primary organization that they work with in terms of spying and getting the message out and propaganda is not AIPAC as much anymore as the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. AIPAC is more useful to them as a lobbying organization. And I think that's the way they see it. AIPAC is a focal point for them to bring in the Christian Zionists, to go and flood Congress every year when they have their summit, and send people over to harass congressmen and their staffs to tell them that you know they have to support Israel. But I think FDD is probably a bigger, more active connection with the spying.
A significant lead. This Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which I mentioned on past programs, was founded the day after September 11. And it has been a major lobbyist for aggressive moves on Iran. And you've heard, listeners have heard Mark Dubowitz, its director, on National Public Radio, and you see him on the talking head, but people do not know the background of this organization, so I'm glad you brought that up. Anything more you could tell us about it?
Yeah, well, FDD, as you say, I mean, the really dangerous thing about FDD is that they are very focused on lobbying for a war with Iran. In fact, not even a war. They're focused on attacking Iran. That's the way they see it, and they're very effective at that. They, for example, if when the U.S. Congress, the Foreign Relations Committee, wants to talk to some experts about what's going on with Iran, Jeff, they don't call me or you in to talk to. They get Mark Dubowitz or Ruel Gurek from the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, and these guys say what is absolutely predictable. And the congressmen sit there and they nod their heads. So these people are incredibly dangerous. They're part of the infrastructure that pretends to provide an intellectual base for a war with Iran, with a country that does not threaten the United States in any way.
And the American people are totally unaware of the function of this organization. How about the role of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the AIPAC spawn that had been very influential with Dennis Ross, the ubiquitous Dennis Ross, all over the place?
Yeah, WINAP, if one were to look at a second most influential lobby with connections with Israeli intelligence, you would probably look at WINAP. Yeah, WINAP was founded by AIPAC because AIPAC, again, was trying to depict itself as an honorable lobby that was presenting honorable views about Israel and the Middle East. So they tried to keep their more crazy elements off in a box somewhere, and that's essentially what WINAP does. You're right. You're quite right. WINAP is absolutely another player in this game, and they are also people that wind up very often on Capitol Hill and talking to congressmen, and their message is exactly the same, that war with Iran is essential because Iran has a secret nuclear program, which no one can find, but they know it's there.
I'm going to get back to Iran a little bit later, but I wanted to go back to the Israeli spying. Some years back, Carl Kamran, a journalist, a respected journalist, did a four-part series on Israeli spying for Fox News. Fox News, yes. And that was disappeared from Fox News. Some people were able to record it, but actually Fox took it off its website. Perhaps you could tell us something about what Carl Kamran found.
Yeah, I luckily enough have a copy of it. Carl Kamran found that the Israelis were actively spying against the U.S. government. That's what basically he was kind of focusing on. And he basically identified the mechanisms for many of the communications companies that operate in the United States are either connected with Israel in one way, or in some cases actually Israeli-owned, and in other cases they use technology that the Israelis have developed. So the Israelis were able to develop access to, for example, Bill Clinton's telephone in his private office where he was talking to Monica Lewinsky. It's the sort of thing the Israelis were able to do. So, the question becomes, these days, in light of the Jeffrey Epstein case, did they have blackmail material on President Bill Clinton? They quite well could have had. And so anyway, Cameron did not speculate in these areas, but he talked about how the spying was going on and how the technology was used and so on and so forth. And for his hard work, he was fired.
Well, it's interesting that this is a subject that simply is off limits for even the alternative media. And that's one of the reasons you're not a talking head on either NPR or many of the mainstream news programs. But I wanted also, they also had a number of Israeli students going around, I understand, trying to get on U.S. military bases selling paintings. It was a strange story. Difficult to figure out what they were trying to do, actually, except get access to American officials and military people.
Yeah, that was the suspicion. That was the art student side of the story. There were as many as 2,000 Israeli art students roaming the United States at that time, and most of these were students. Although a lot of them were people who had they had completed their requirement as soldiers in Israel, and were apparently coming over here for a post-military experience vacation. So a lot of them were military. And they were selling cosmetics at shopping malls. They were, in some cases, trying to get access to military facilities. There was a notorious case, I think, in Georgia, where they were trying to get into a nuclear submarine base. So they were around. And they were, again, this was something the FBI and others were very much aware of and Cameron picked up on. But nothing essentially was done about it. The in the wake of 9/11, in addition to the five dancing Israelis, about 135 other Israelis were arrested. They were questioned, but in every case, they were essentially allowed to leave the country.
Now, when 9/11 happened, the first response on the part of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the perennial prime minister, was a good thing. A good thing, he said. And you were right that 9/11 was a gift to Israel and is a gift that keeps on giving. Perhaps you could tell us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, if you look at 9/11 in terms of who had a motive for it to happen, Israel is number one. I mean, Israel basically saw 9/11, and as Netanyahu said after the fact, as a gift that this involved the United States in its war against Islam, and meant that the United States would be in its pocket for the foreseeable future, which of course it has been. And so he, you know, the motive. If you look at motive, there it was. What were the motives of Al-Qaeda to do it? Well, they're more diffuse. Bin Laden, in his own writings, of course, never actually said that his group did it, but he laid out a lot of reasons why the United States was a force for evil in the world. So they had motive too, but the fact is the direct motive, the most compelling motive, was the motive that Israel had for 9/11 to occur.
Well, it certainly brought the United States into the Middle East as an occupier, so it couldn't really point the finger at Israel so much as an occupier. As I recall, that Israelis had U.S. Marines come into towns to watch how the Israelis were occupying Palestinian villages to get a tip on how they could do the same thing when the U.S. was occupying a village. It's something I remember was in the media at the time and then slipped by. But it's an important change. Now it seems that all of Israel's enemies have become our enemies. No?
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And also the training has expanded, where now it's routine for police forces from the United States to go to Israel for training. Military units from the United States go to Israel for joint exercises. And we also have now, for the first time in the last couple of years, an actual military base in Israel that will serve as a tripwire if Israel starts a war. And there is some response from whoever they're attacking, the United States will be in the middle of it immediately.
Now, this brings up a very important point. Israel is looking for another war with Hezbollah because Hezbollah has kind of humiliated Israel twice, first forcing Israel out of Lebanon after 18 years of occupation as a result of protests in the streets by Israeli mothers who were complaining that their sons were being bumped off in Lebanon for nothing. And then in 2006, they stopped and vaunted Israel Defense Forces on the ground. And the Israeli press keeps always talking about the next war with Lebanon, with Hezbollah, as if it's like a hurricane that's going to occur. And the United States seems to have adopted Hezbollah as an enemy as much as any other enemy. What's your take on that?
Yeah, this is one of the stranger stories. Yeah, you know, obviously Hezbollah and Israel have a history that goes back 50 years. And Israel has always seen Iran as its principal threat, but it sees Hezbollah and also Syria as regimes that are associated with Iran. And so it's always been tempted to try to take them out or to do something that reduces their ability to respond if they're attacked. And right now, the situation, from what I'm reading and what I'm seeing, is that the Israelis would like to do something about Hezbollah, but they are in fact concerned that Hezbollah has the capability to hit back hard, that it has a lot of variable quality missiles, but enough to overwhelm Israeli defenses, and a lot of Israelis would possibly die. So I think that's why we have kind of a standoff at the moment. And of course, the trick on all these situations is that when Israel is not willing to act by itself, it brings in the United States, and consequently, Hezbollah is now being denounced regularly by our Secretary of State, among others, and it's receiving the same treatment as Iran. But you know, we shall see how this plays out. Not particularly with Bolton out of the picture. One might have a dim bit of hope that a lot of this will change. We will see.
My guest is Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer, and we're talking about Israel 9/11. But you mentioned John Bolton. I did want to get your thoughts, significance of his being fired or resigning at the hands of Donald Trump, and what do you think that means for two things: one, U.S.-Israel relations, and also situation, the U.S. versus Iran and Hezbollah.
Well, I don't think it means much, to be honest. I think that the U.S.-Israel relationship is cemented in concrete by Congress, the White House, and the media. That's not going to shift as a result of his leaving. His replacement is just as pro is in fact a Zionist Jew, and it's very much just as strong on the issue of Israel as Bolton is, that temporary replacement. You know, I don't think it's going to change things with Iran either. I kind of wonder if Trump will again try the option of Rouhani, but that's not going to work until they're willing to lift sanctions. Rouhani just won't do it.
Evidently, of course, they're probably celebrating because, interesting, Bolton was a benefactor of the largesse of Sheldon Adelson and mm-hmm. was appointed to the national security position, advisor position, at Adelson's request. And now, and Adelson, of course, was also friendly with Netanyahu, and because of their Netanyahu's difficult position vis-a-vis the law and his efforts to kind of interfere with Adelson newspaper, which was a mouthpiece for him. I'm curious your thoughts if the Adelson-Trump relationship will change, because Adelson was the one who pushed Trump to hire Bolton. What do your tea leaves show you?
Well, I would suspect that Trump cleared this with Adelson before he did it. You're absolutely right. Adelson was the one who pushed for Bolton. And that would mean to me that Trump has suggested some replacements for Bolton that he would be able to work with better, who are politically pretty much close to what Bolton represented. That would be my thinking. We're only one day into it now, and I'm certainly seeing a lot of different opinions, but I think that he would have discussed this with Adelson before he did it.
Adelson's having some of his own problems, it seems, with his casinos. But his connections with Netanyahu are a bit frayed. Mm-hmm. How do you see, while we're on the subject of Israel and the U.S., the Israeli elections playing out next week? Netanyahu has now announced if he wins, because he said this before, he's planning to annex or, what he says actually is provide Israeli sovereignty to all the Jewish settlements in what he calls Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. His opponents have said he's promised that before, but it seems with Trump in, he has a situation where he's not likely to have a president as so supportive of Israel in the future as Trump is. What's your take on all that?
Yeah, no, I think your analysis is exactly right. I think that what we're going to see is that this time Netanyahu will do it. He'll pull the trigger. And I think he's already spoken to Trump on the issue, and Trump has already indicated to him that the United States will be supportive. That's what I expect to see.
Our elections are coming up, and the subject of Israel has been avoided, clearly avoided in all the debates. And I'm wondering if you see any prospect of a revolt within the Democratic Party, because the base seems to, according to polls, have turned away from Israel, not supporting so much the Palestinians, no longer ready to give Israel a free ride. And conceivably, in next year's Democratic Convention, we could have a major split, a very public split, if they have someone like Joe Biden pushed as a candidate.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, you know, on one hand, you almost would have to say that we're looking at something approaching a civil war between the Democratic Party organization and the party base over the issue of Israel. But I suspect what we're going to see between now and the conventions next summer is that the organization will be trying to work out ways to make sure that this dissent doesn't surface. In other words, they won't let them speak. They won't let them have the floor. They won't let them propose any motions. I absolutely see this kind of solution coming up. They don't. Nancy Pelosi and those around her and Joe Biden, they absolutely do not want to deal with this issue, and they do not want to deal with the fact that more than half of their base is enchanted with Israel. That is a given. The only question would be exactly how are they going to maneuver to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Well, I know. I remember 1968 in Chicago. I was there on the outside, and the number of protesters there were very slim. The story was very big because the press was also beaten up by the Chicago police. But in Milwaukee, there's going to be a number of young delegates who will not be happy with what the DNC has been doing. They already saw what they did with Hillary versus Bernie Sanders, and some have argued that, in fact, they're the ones who put Trump in the White House. And that this is, and some have argued, like myself, that the Democrats would rather lose with Biden and lose control of the party to the younger members. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that, again, I think that the older members of the party who have been spending their entire lives in pandering to Israel are not going to be willing to. They have all kinds of reasons that they think support doing that kind of thing, and I don't think they're going to be wanting to shift in any way on that. But you know, you're right. I mean, the younger members of the party, who will be a significant block in terms of numbers, see these things quite differently. But the question is, will the party organization be able to figure out mechanisms that don't allow this issue to come to the fore? And I'm not, you know, predicting that's going to happen, but that is I think what they will be trying to achieve. But you know, we'll see as we get closer to the nomination process. Clearly, as you say, no one is willing to talk about Israel right now. But there have been some hints from some of the candidates that they're not too happy about Israeli behavior. I mean, that's a big breakthrough.
Well, Phil, You are the last guest on my last Takes on the World program. I'm very happy to have had you as a guest many times over the years, and I want to wish you continue to write and tell the truth, and I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World, and I wish you well and our listeners to go and find your you write for UNS Review, and where else could we find your work?
Yeah, UNS.com, and also I post all my stuff on Facebook.
Well, very good. Phil Giraldi, thanks again for being our guest on Takes on the World. Take care.
Thank you, Jeff.
Bye-bye. Now, for the last time, this has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.